speak in the name of the living God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Be seated. I read my chapter from Jen Hatmaker's book 7 on a flight to Naples for a one-day meeting, followed by a flight home after spending about 36 hours on Italian soil. I couldn't help feeling that the trip was very wasteful. I also wondered what Jen would have made of it, given the simplification stance in her book. I certainly wasn't living in the moment and simplifying my life while I consumed a great deal of fuel for a very short visit. However, I want to say that I don't think that this book, or my chapter on food, is necessarily a book aimed at stopping us from living our lives as we see fit. What it is about is making sure that when I live my life as I see fit, it is because I see it as fit, not just because it's what happens. Jen is challenging our default setting. For me, as a relatively affluent middle-class Englishman, it's probably a sense of entitlement and a desire to have what I want right now, regardless of anybody else. What the book does is ask me to challenge that default setting and justify it to myself if I can. It asks me to take responsibility for what I am doing, not just to drift through life. In this book, Jen sets herself a challenge. Over the course of 7 months, she will address an area of her life each month and determine what is necessary and what is just distraction. She wants to remove excess from her life so she can get closer to God. The seven is a continued motif throughout the book. She chooses 7 foods to eat in month one. In month two, she chooses 7 clothes to wear. In month three, she gives away 7 possessions every day, and so forth. I won't say more than that because I don't want to spoil it for the other preachers. But my chapter is on food. And the 7 foods that Jen chooses are chicken, eggs, whole wheat bread, sweet potatoes, spinach, avocados, and apples. When Jen chooses the 7 foods, she does so by carefully considering the nutrition that each will provide. She also tries to imagine what things she'll not end up hating after 1 week. She's not quite successful. She ends up very bored of chicken. She doesn't go, what would I have to eat if I was in a refugee camp in Somalia? Or anything like that. It's a simplification of an affluent American diet, not one done in sympathy with people in abject poverty. As an aside, some of her friends do eat like the poorest residents in a chosen poor country, such as Haiti, for a few days as they pray for that country. But that's not the main point that we're looking at here. What Jen is actually trying to do is to learn to appreciate what she has and find out what she needs. She needs to meet her nutritional requirements. This isn't some form of crash diet or political statement. She wants to connect more closely with God in denial and in removal of trappings that drag her back to her comfort zone. She is simplifying, not sacrificing herself. This chapter certainly touches upon the difference between the haves and the have-nots. But it really isn't the main thing that's going on. Jen doesn't actually use it to try to evoke images of starving people who have less than she has. Nor, for that matter, does she tell us that she gives what she saves on groceries to the poor either. Poverty is in many ways a distraction from what she is trying to achieve, which is a deeper spiritual understanding of who God is and what he wants her to be like. Equally, I don't want to present Jen as heartless. She regularly notes that she cries as she thinks about people who have less than her. or rebukes herself when she wavers over a coffee in an airport terminal, while much of the world does not even have access to such things. She also presents her horror when her kids throw away a large amount of dinner just because there was no ketchup to go with it. Poverty simply isn't the main thing that is going on. What Jen is doing in the chapter most clearly reminded me of our gospel passage last week, which was a reading from Matthew 6, 16 to 18, where it is written, "When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face, so that it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father who is unseen. And your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." Jesus also reminds us that, Jen also reminds us that Jesus' ministry actually started with a 40-day fast in which he is emptied so that he can be refilled. This isn't about other people. This is about her and God. The benefits to others will arise from the grace that she receives and the mission that God will use her for. Theologically, there is a lot we could look at around food. There are the food laws with banned and permitted food, as we heard about in our reading from the Old Testament. There are the instructions about not reaping to the edge of the field so that the widows and the sojourners in your land have something to eat. There is the fair sharing of food among the members of the early church. However, I don't propose to dwell on most of them in any detail, other than to note that there are reasons for permitting and denying certain foods, and they all served very practical purposes when they were initiated. We, however, sit in a privileged position following the gospel reading today, where all foods are permitted. We can choose what we want to eat because it is what we do that matters, not what we consume. This could lead me down another path, as there are many discussions going on at present around sustainability, vegetarianism or veganism, and the destruction of the planet. But I don't really intend to talk about them much either. I'm not touching on them because I feel they're probably going to distract us from what we need to hear. I encourage everyone to think about what they eat, how they eat, and where they eat. I also encourage you to consider whether we should be sharing our food better than we do. Please do engage with the political debate if that's what you want to do. As stewards of creation, we probably should be shouting about abuses of the planet. Just don't go pinning it on this book. This book is about our own relationship with God, not anybody else's. Jen's husband, Brandon, does the challenges with her, but it isn't a crusade as such, and her friends are there to keep her honest, not to travel the same journey. One of the key things that Jen discovers is how difficult it is to live a simple, fasting life. She is surrounded by food and realizes how little she appreciates it. When she goes out with friends in Austin, Texas, where she lives, she can't get a simple chicken salad, a chicken and spinach salad. And even when she can, she convinces the restaurant to prepare her one, it comes out dressed in a rich vinaigrette, which she's not supposed to be eating. They simply don't understand that she wants a plain salad. She herself and those who surround her are consumers and don't have an easy time simplifying things. As a consumer, on many occasions, she ends up angry that she can't have what she wants. But equally, on several occasions, when she's at the end of her tether, she stumbles upon a recipe that uses the precise ingredients that she is allowed, which reinvigorates her and gets her back on track in her task of simplification. She even finds the hunger pangs useful in helping her to remember to pray, and wonders if this is why people rarely fast for one day. because it takes her several days to get to the point she can cope with the hunger and concentrate on God. There were many tears in the chapter, but also a pure, simple, joyful realization that God can be relied upon to provide what we need. So it's a chapter about fasting, which Jen interprets as simplifying things. But what does the Bible say about fasting? Well, fasting as such is not well defined in Scripture, although it is often interpreted as a complete lack of food and only drinking water. However, it seems unlikely that that is always what is meant, as we're told about several fasts of up to 40 days and nights. And at this point, I should say, it's generally regarded that someone doing that would be dead, so it seems unlikely that a complete lack of food can be meant for these extended fasts. On some occasions, notably in Daniel 10, a partial fast from meat, dairy foods and delicacies, as well as alcohol, is mentioned. Later on in the Christian era, fasting is certainly not defined as a complete lack of food. In the writings of St. Augustine, he simply restricts the number of meals per day to three: one large meal in the evening and two small meals, not totaling as much as the large meal, in the morning and at noon. Fasting is also always done for a reason. It is not intended to be the end in itself. Fasting is done at times of mourning, either individual or national, at times of need, and at times of prayer. It is a devotion to show that one is dependent on God for everything. Foregoing food acknowledges that one is totally dependent on God for life. Israel, for example, fasted in penitence for their sins in Nehemiah 9, chapter, verse 1. Personal fasting is presented in Psalm 25, verse 13. And liturgical fasting is presented in Zechariah 8, 19. There is no merit in fasting without reason. It is a spiritual discipline. We do it to approach God. In the later church, as I said, rules of fasting are defined quite closely, and fast days are ascribed. On these fast days, certain foods might be restricted, and abstinence from alcohol is pretty much assumed. I grew up in a Catholic family, and we observed a fast on most Fridays, as meat was not permitted. On those days, we generally had fish or vegetarian food, and during Lent, fasts were more strictly observed, particularly on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday. And over the Easter weekend, we only ate simple meals until Easter Sunday after church, when we celebrated with a roast dinner. This pretty much followed the pattern that was set down for the Catholic Church by Pope Paul VI in the 1960s. The Book of Common Prayer sets out days for Anglicans to fast, and again, Lent is one of those times, as it is for most of the older Christian churches, such as the Greek and Russian Orthodoxies and the Coptic Church. Again, all of these churches set limits of a fast, and it is not generally abstinence from all food for periods of more than one day. Generally, simple meals are allowed, often only one per day and without meat, but in many cases a light breakfast and lunch are allowed. In all cases there are exemptions from fasting, including for those who with medical conditions, pregnant and nursing women, and often the very young and the elderly. On a side note, the church in America at one point defined beavers as fish, and the church in England defined some geese as fruit or shellfish in order to allow them to be eaten on fast days. Beavers, if you really push it, I can see where they're coming from. But the geese as fruit thing is harder to accept. The logic goes something like this. Barnacle geese don't breed in this country. Ergo, they don't have babies. They appear fully fledged, sorry, and then they don't have babies. They appear at the time of harvest almost overnight on the lakes. Ergo, they must fall from the trees. What falls from the trees? Ah, fruit. So they're a fruit. We can therefore eat them on a Friday. If you don't believe me, look it up. There are diagrams in serious zoological textbooks showing the life cycle of the barnacle goose. They are admittedly from the 12th century. On a similar note, and in areas where there are no fruit trees, they were thought to come from barnacles, hence the name, and were therefore a shellfish and could be eaten on a Friday. This shows that people who should know better will cheat just to get what they actually want, and surely likens them to the person described in Matthew 6 with a dirty and disfigured face. But why do we fast, particularly on holy days? Fasting is a discipline that is intended to allow us to approach God with humility. Without you, I have nothing. Without distraction, no thought is needed for what I'm having for dinner tonight. Without comfort, my hunger pangs remind me that you are Lord and I must pray and praise you. With earnestness and urgency. This is important enough for me to give up the things I like and ultimately that I need to live. Without God, fasting means nothing. But with God, it reminds us that we are but dust, and to dust we will return, as we acknowledged on Wednesday. As in our gospel, it is what comes out of us that matters, not what goes into us. Jen chooses her foods carefully, but by limiting herself and makes food preparation easier. By foregoing snacks and complex meals to prepare, she makes time in her day to pray and to devote herself to God. Without God at its center, it would be a strict diet, but with God, it is a gateway to a more spiritual life. A centering that she needs to express her faith more thoroughly. The important thing is what she becomes, not what she eats. Most of the books and articles I've read on the subject of fasting finish by saying, wouldn't the church and its people be in a better place if we undertook this discipline more regularly? I don't say that we should give up food, but by intentionally eating, as Jen does, and remembering from whom we get our food, we can perhaps develop a healthy relationship with food and keep our needs separate from our wants and put more of a focus on God rather than on what cake I should eat today. And while we grow closer to God and come to know how he wants us to live, we will experience compassion for those who have less than us. I was struggling to find a way to finish this sermon, and then I listened to Sean and Shauna talk last week. Sean used a sentence that condensed everything into one shape that builds on that sentiment of compassion. The sentence was, when we look at our relationship with God, we look at our relationship with each other. That's it. I'm sure I read something about that earlier in my research. Oh yeah, here it is, Isaiah 58. But paraphrased slightly. Is this not the fast that I have chosen? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? As we come to know God better by removing the stuff which gets in the way, we will want to live more simply and to help those less fortunate than ourselves. The food bank will grow and serve those in crisis in our district. Cookhouse will prepare meals for all comers. We will break bread together and share in each other's lives. We must grow in compassion as we fulfill Jesus' new commandment, love one another as I have loved you. To know God better is to know love. and then we must share that love with our brothers and sisters. Correcting our relationship with food is just the first step. As we continue this sermon series, looking at clothes, social media, possessions, and waste, we have the opportunity to assess who we really are in God. We have the opportunity to become the humans we were designed to be, in relationship with each other and in relationship with God.